Thank you very much, Mr. Moore. Greetings to all of you. Let's go ahead and go over to Genesis 4, if you would. I have to mention, make a disclaimer here, there was no collusion between Mr. Moore and myself, but we're going to talk about something very similar. I want to say, as Paul said to the churches, grace and peace to you from the Father and from Jesus Christ. And I want to talk about war today also, because the world has not known the way of peace. It all started very wonderfully, the angels shouting for joy, the earth created, and then finally a man was made, a woman was made from his rib, and they were placed in a magnificent and beautiful garden. And at that time, the animals all roamed free. They didn't rip and tear, fight one another, and then the enemy of God seduced the woman into taking of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And she then came to believe that we could choose for ourselves. We could determine what was right and what was wrong. And she ate and she gave to her husband and he ate. And as a result, mankind suffered death. And the animals feared mankind. And the earth brought forth weeds and briars and so on. But that wasn't all. Because man had taken the power to choose right from wrong, jealousy developed. Some wanted to be more right than others. And so we see this in Genesis 4 and verse 3. Genesis 4, verse 3, and in the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought of the fruit of the ground an offering unto the Lord. And Abel he also brought of the firstlings of his flock, and of the fat thereof. And the Lord had respect unto Abel and his offering, but unto Cain and his offering respect. And Cain was very wroth, and his countenance fell. And the Lord said unto Cain, why are you wroth? Why is your countenance fallen? If you do well, shall not you be accepted? And if you don't do well, sin lies at the door. And unto you shall be its desire, and you shall rule over it. And so we see jealousy beginning to take place here. Cain was jealous of his brother, and he didn't want anyone to appear better than he was. And so we continue here in verse 8. And Cain talked with Abel his brother, and it came to pass when they were in the field that Cain rose up against Abel his brother and slew him. Soon, being more powerful than others, became an issue of pride. And in verse 23, for example, he said to his wives, Ada and Zillah, hear my voice, you wives of Lamech. Hear unto my speech, for I've slain Cain, and a young man to my hurt. If Cain shall be avenged, truly Lamech 70 and sevenfold. And so it developed more and more. As the earth became more populated, it became more violent as time went on. Genesis 6, verse 5. And God saw that the wickedness of man became great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And it repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him in his heart. And so the world became violent. It was a world of violence. I remember going to a museum and seeing some of the skeletons from that time in history. And there were so many skulls that had cracks and holes in them from that time because violence, they said, had become a way of life for those people. And then it wasn't long, and Noah and his family, of course, started out. God destroyed everybody. Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord in verse 8. But these are the generations of Noah. He was just and perfect in his generation, and he walked with God. And so after this, there was the development in Genesis 10. So God destroys all of the people on earth because it had become so violent and so wicked, and man's every thought was evil. And So he destroys them, saves Noah, and it begins all over again. Genesis 10 and verse 8. And Cush begot Nimrod, and he came to be a mighty one in the earth and a mighty hunter before the Lord. Wherefore it said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter, before or against God. And so he built a tower, perhaps, as some think, to save himself if there was another flood. But the point is that he built this Tower of Babel, and then God intervened, changing their languages, and they left off building this tower. But they took Nimrod's religion with them. And so then they were all these different names for the same kind of religion, and that evolved into what we have today, where, as was stated, that, you know, 80-some gods for war, more. It's unbelievable what has developed from all that. So anyway, chapter 16, let's go there for a moment. After this, a demonstration of power became kind of a way of life. And Abraham experienced war, you remember, with title, King of Nations. And then he went into his handmaid, Hagar, and bore Ishmael. And so Genesis 16, 10 through 12. 16, 10 through 12. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, I'll multiply your seed exceedingly, that it be not numbered for multitude. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, behold, you are with child, shall bear a son, and call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has heard thy affliction. And he will be a wild man, and his hand will be against every man, and every man's hand against him. And he'll dwell in the presence of all his brethren. And so it is that we see the very beginnings of what eventually became an alliance between he and Esau's children. And we see Isis today as the ultimate result, with his hand against his brother. The world simply has not known the way of peace. War has been the pattern, as we heard from the very beginning, fighting and killing other men for your own benefit, for more power. And the art of war has grown to enormous proportions. And as was stated earlier, I remember I read in the New York Times that it was 250 years of peace out of 3,400 years of history. And that was by piecing days, weeks, and months together to accumulate that much. The New York Times said the total number killed in wars throughout all human history ranges up to 1 billion people killed in war. The total number of casualties in World War I was 37 million. And that was one of the most deadly conflicts that the world had ever seen up to that point, until we had World War II. And World War II had many more, actually. 72 million people died in that conflict. 72 million people died. Now, I want you to think about this personally. That's the people that died. Those people were probably in the best condition. You understand? The rest of the people, how many more were wounded? How many more lost limbs? How many more were blinded or deaf because of war? The victims are just, the count is enormous because of this way of life. And so after World War I, the governments of the world believed they needed to do something to prevent this thing called war. And so they developed the League of Nations, and that didn't work, and so it led to World War II. After World War II, they realized, we've got to do something. Now we have the atom bomb. We've got to do something, and so they created the United Nations. And it was to be the solution to man's problem of war. Go ahead and start the video.
Math of World War II. The leaders of the world created the United Nations to ensure global security and protect human rights. And those ideals were enshrined in the UN's charter, which begins with the words, "We the peoples," meant to reflect the United States Constitution. And today, the UN continues to pursue those ideals, like fighting the spread of disease by vaccinating millions of people, or combating famine by feeding tens of millions more. And during refugee crises, it is often the only actor willing and able to help. But lately, the UN's reputation doesn't seem to reflect this grand mission.
It's been a year of duck and cover here under a deluge of bad news.
It's so disgraceful. The former Commission on Human Rights had to be disbanded.
The derided United Nations Human Rights Commission is a human rights violation on its own.
A rather depressing list of international relations.
New allegations that top UN officials may have been bribed by Saddam.
Budget diplomat indicted for money laundering.
Allegations of sexual misconduct by UN peacekeepers.
About the UN compared to a global Tammany Hall.
By the time all these guys talk, 50,000 more people are going to be dead.
Because UN doesn't seem to care. It's unbelievable.
They're supposed to help prevent violence. Now they're accused of causing it.
The UN has made a mockery of human rights. It's never.
The UN has failed to live up to the ideals.
Nonsensical and ineffective organization.
The UN has ceased functioning as it was meant to.
The Parliament of the World, just a toothless talking shop.
That's man's solution to war. Is to create the UN, and yet they wanted to prevent war, but there's currently 40 wars going on between tribes, nations, and peoples around the world. People dying from this violence, and some horrifically even tortured. So think, the UN must be frantically working to deal with these 40 wars that are going on. But what exactly are they doing to stop the wars?
Needed to get some answers, so I went to the nerve center of it all. I can only imagine all the tense negotiations that must be going on right now.
Hello? No, nobody here.
You know, the world benefits on the whole by having the UN. At the same time, it's a funny place. They'll discuss some vital issue, AIDS or Darfur or some crisis, and expound about how urgent it is, and then say, oh, it's 1:15, let's go to lunch. And they'll go off and have lunch for 2 or 3 hours, and this is what they do. It's an odd place. People take naps at the UN. You know, they bring their culture with them. After lunch, you find people dozing off. Illustrating this is a case where the UN, which has guards, one of the officers took his break. I think it was 10 o'clock in the morning, and they find him lying in a chair with his service revolver in his hand, and he had evidently committed suicide by shooting himself in the head. It's a sad story, but what makes this a UN story is that in the chair adjacent to this fellow is another UN guard, sound asleep.
Oh, you're working late.
Sorry?
You're working late. It's already past 6.
Yeah, I know.
With 16 peacekeeping missions happening around the globe, in almost every time zone, you'd think there'd be people still around here.
Hello? Hello?
Something tells me we're not going to find answers in these empty hallways.
So the UN was created especially to deal with rogue nations that were out there that were dangerous. And instead, the UN has actually given those rogue nations legitimacy. It's clear that man's attempt to deal with the problem of war has been and is a failure. The UN, all that seems that they're capable of is talk. Their main mission has turned into protecting themselves rather than people. And there's been so much misconduct that's come from the UN of late. Corruption and bribes and sex trafficking have been in the news that they have been doing. And so everyone is collecting their check, but nobody seems to be doing their job. Let's go over to Proverbs 20 for a moment, if you will. Proverbs 20. Corruption appears to run rampant in the world that we live in, and it's certainly no different in the United Nations today. People have attempted to work there. They've given a sincere effort, but there's so much incompetence that nothing seems to get done right. And not only that, but then there's a corruption where people are serving themselves rather than the UN or rather than the countries that need their help. And so the video that we're playing pieces from is the UN and me. And the commentator looks inside the UN, exactly what is being done there. And their attempt will often look good at the beginning, but the policies aren't continued. They're not enforced, and they don't continue on. And so chaos often develops. They do little to follow up and ensure that those things continue. And so our attempts, our human attempts to assuage the war and the suffering that comes from it end again in failure. The problem is that people care more about themselves than they do others. And this is why we have that commandment from God to love your neighbor as yourself. Anyway, Proverbs 20 and verse 6 says this: most men will proclaim everyone his own goodness, but a faithful man, who can find? That's the question. Who is faithful, and what are we doing? Are we being faithful in our mission to stop or prevent war and help people in the world? You know, the UN employees will proclaim their goodness. They're doing good. But sometimes it has become a cover itself for evil. Go ahead.
I graduated from law school in 1991.
This is Ken Kane. He was a peacekeeper at the end of the Cold War.
If you were young and you were sentient at that moment, you wanted to see what was happening in the world. You wanted to watch the world remake itself because it was happening in real time. It was one of those very dramatic, powerful, inspiring moments. And right then, the biggest peacekeeping mission in history was being staffed in Cambodia. So I was young, I was stupid, I was naive. And they were looking for young lawyers, you know, who were prepared to get on a helicopter and go to Southeast Asia. And I was in front of that line. The mission in Cambodia was to conduct a free and fair election for probably the first time in Indochina. You register folks, you put up a polling booth, you get them there, you get them out. It's logistics, and the UN can do that. It was a beautiful election. 96% of eligible Cambodians voted. A democratically elected government was born out of the hell of the middle of Indochina. It was enormously, genuinely inspiring, and the UN did one hell of a job. In retrospect, you can start to see the seeds for all of the problems that you could see later on. No discipline and no accountability.
Yes, I did work for the UN for about 12 years in New York and in the field.
This is a former peacekeeper. He agreed to talk with us only if we hid his identity.
And in Cote d'Ivoire, I was paid to do nothing. When I went to complain to the chief of personnel, he said, "You're not here to complain, you're not here to work. Enjoy the beach, have beer, go out with the chicks." End of quote.
There was a need for Bulgarian males to serve in Cambodia, and they didn't want to send their best troops. And so what they did is they found kind of their least desirable soldiers on their rosters. And some of those guys came from halfway houses and psychiatric units. Some of them were just running riot through Cambodia. So they were crashing their cars, they were raping girls, they got in a bad firefight with the Khmer Rouge on a gambling issue, but nobody ever got disciplined. But the biggest thing in my mind is you are there to help the Cambodians. And when they start to perceive that, no, actually it looks like you're there to run riot, that moral authority starts to disintegrate. And when that's gone, that's really all the UN has.
After these interviews, I decided that I had to check out a peacekeeping mission for myself. Since the mission in Cote d'Ivoire is still active, I wanted to follow up on this peacekeeper story. And who could resist? Beaches, beer, and babes. After a coup attempt in 2002 split the country in half, the Ivorians asked the UN to help them repair their country. So in 2004, the United Nations mission in Côte d'Ivoire, UNOC, was born.
Hello, Mr. Torrey?
Yeah, my name is Amir Horowitz, and I just flew in from America, and would love to get an interview with Abu Musa, the head of the UN mission. So who's the right person?
Yeah, no problem, I'll hold.
I've been holding for no, please. Yeah, you know, I only need like a few minutes, not a very long time. Yeah, I can fax something, sure. Give me your number. Mm-hmm. Great.
While I was waiting for the UNOC office to get back to me, I met with some Ivorian officials to see how the UN was working out for them.
Les troupes onusiennes sont donc arrivées en Côte d'Ivoire et, comme ça se passe d'ailleurs partout ailleurs, les casques bleus, au lieu d'être dans la zone de combat, dans la zone sur la ligne de front, les troupes de l'ONU ne veulent pas prendre de risques dans les combats. Parce que ce sont des gens, des individus qui sont venus là pour avoir un meilleur traitement financier.
In the beginning of my job, I saw something which shocked me. One colonel in ONUC, he demanded to help him, and we packed all of the wood and the boxes in the warehouse, and we went another district, like something secret. If it wasn't traffic, the movement will be done between two offices of ONUC.
Did they tell you not to say anything?
Yes, they tell us it's in between us. So you can traffic anything. The man had become rich in this mission.
On top of your salary, you'd go at the end of the month to the personnel office, to the cashier, and they would hand you a thick stack of $100 bills. A thick stack of $100 bills. And that was on top of your salary, which was going right into your bank account, most of which is untaxed. The housing is taken care of. Most of your food is either taken care of or quite cheap. So you can put away $80,000 or $90,000 tax-free dollars a year, and you're living high in the hog, you're living really well, and the cash is coming out of your ears every month.
Ils ne risquent pas leur vie pour s'interposer quand il y a des combats, et ils ne sont pas sur les fronts, ils sont tout le temps dans les plages.
Boy, was he right. We hit the beach and the place was hopping with peacekeepers.
The UN seemed like such a good idea in its beginnings, but it's ended up that you cannot find a faithful man. As the scripture said, where can you find a faithful man? Well, I think that it's really getting more difficult all the time because people are looking out for their own interests. And what's shocking is that now we have cases where the UN peacekeepers fired on innocent people, men and women, that had no weapons at all. And they did this using powerful force on innocent people. And it was for their own gain or their own ends. It wasn't to keep the peace. So let's go ahead and look at that.
I tried reaching Abu Musa again. I really wanted to speak to him about an incident I'm pretty sure isn't covered in the UN handbook.
Yeah, I already sent in the fax request. Well, why did he tell me to send it if the machine was broken? Yeah, I can send it again. When are you going to fix it?
When the UN decided to send a peacekeeping mission into Côte d'Ivoire, France volunteered the use of their troops. After all, what's a better way to ensure your influence in a former colony than 4,000 heavily armed troops under a UN mandate? Tensions between the Ivorians and the peacekeepers had run high since the start of the mission. There were rumors of rampant sexual abuse, and peacekeepers had been arrested for robbing a bank. In early November 2004, the French peacekeepers had a serious altercation with the Ivorian military. But it was 3 days later when the tensions hit a new high. A contingent of heavily armed peacekeepers moved to Abidjan's landmark, the Hotel Ivoire. Incensed by the actions of the French, who seemed to act more like a colonial power than a United Nations peacekeeping force, Ivorians confronted the peacekeepers with a peaceful protest.
Mm-hmm.
Il y avait toutes sortes de personnes. Il y avait des vieux, il y avait des jeunes, des étudiants, toute la catégorie de personnes ou bien de classe sociale.
Ok, à partir de la position où nous étions, les manifestants, eux, sont comme ça. Et ici, il y a des barbelés. On a entendu des coups de feu. Et les coups de feu venaient de là.
They had in this hotel sharpshooters.
Oui, mais je crois que c'est ce qui s'est passé.
Why is it, do you think, that the peacekeepers began shooting into your crowd?
On ne faisait que chanter, mais ce qui a provoqué les tirs, là je ne sais pas.
Je n'ai pas pensé qu'on puisse faire ça à des êtres humains qui sont sans armes, mais nus, on tire sur leur bout pourtant.
You know, it's amazing how easy it is to forget your mission and why you're there and take things into your own hands. And I've seen this happen a number of times in the Church of God. I've seen it in my own life, where I forget sometimes what I'm called to. Let's go over to Matthew 24. You know, in times past, the nations went from the sword or from rocks to knives and swords and to guns, and then finally to bombs, as we saw in the sermonette earlier. And now we have nuclear proliferation, the likes of which we never imagined. And there's now, according to World Peace Org, 26,000 nuclear warheads in the world. Just one is going to be way more than Hiroshima or Nagasaki. In fact, we have now 5 to 7 times more power than we need to destroy the earth. We can do it 5 to 7 times more. Matthew 24 and verse 21, then shall be great tribulation such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time known or ever shall be. This is what's coming. War like we've never dreamed of. And except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. And so the point is that we're coming to a point in life, in history, where we have the power to erase all life from off the earth. And now, at the same time, each nation seems to be in a rush to strap on their nuclear gun belts. Each nation seems to want to get the bomb.
You grieve, 'cause they're on our side, I believe. China got the bomb, but have no fears. They can't wipe us out for at least 5 years. Who's next? So Israel's getting tense, wants one in self-defense. The Lord is our shepherd, says the psalm. But just in case, we better get a bomb. Who's next? Who's next? Who's next? Who's next?
The Iranian president made an important announcement today, saying that his country had reached a point where it was now capable of making what he described as industrialized quantities of enriched uranium.
If the UN continues to define Iran's pursuit of nuclear energy as illegal, Iran is simply not going to stop, but will pursue that illegal action. We've heard earlier from Iranian officials.
Iran is the latest in a series of countries seeking to acquire the bomb. As I took a closer look at what the UN was doing to stop all of this, a strange paradox became clear. While on one hand, the UN is trying to keep a lid on proliferation, the other hand is spoon-feeding nuclear technology to any country requesting it, in an effort to promote nuclear energy around the world.
Unfortunately, that process is pretty much the same process for making bomb material. It's not that different. When you go into the International Atomic Energy Agency, there's a big trophy case in the center area that features prominently a trophy awarded to the IAEA by the Pakistani Atomic Energy Agency for all the help. But they have bombs. They don't have much of a civil program, but they have definitely have a serious bomb program. North Korea, Iran, India, Pakistan have all benefited from the technical assistance program.
And for that, a system of verification was established through the agency in Vienna, the Atomic Energy Agency, by which the international community can be reasonably sure that there is no diversion of those materials for weapons purposes.
We were accompanied by busloads of ambassadors who observed this whole process, and this became ludicrous, because how can you conduct a surprise inspection and also transport, notify, and have all these ambassadors show up? Every place we went was completely swept clean. There was not one single piece of paper in evidence.
They had cameras that were supposed to surveil the nuclear sites in that country. But it was interesting. The batteries in the cameras would break down and fail.
For the most part, the agency does not know whether the camera has been blocked, whether the lights have been turned out, or whether the camera's been destroyed.
Well, the IAEA has a problem, which is that it can only go to places where it's invited to look. And those places are never the places where people are misusing the technology and making nuclear weapons out of it.
It was all about process. It was not about results. The results were worthless.
How could it be worthless? The IAEA receives more than $380 million per year to spend as it sees fit. In fact, it spends 80% of its nuclear inspection budget on three rogue regimes: Germany, Japan, and Canada. But Germany, Japan, and Canada don't seem to make the news all that often when it comes to nuclear weapons programs. One country that does is Iran. Iran keeps telling us they just want nuclear energy. Well, where else will they get their energy?
Polonium-210 is used to initiate the chain reaction in a nuclear weapon. It's one of the only practical uses of that material, and certainly the only one in Iran that makes any sense. If a country is experimenting with this material, it means that they've got nuclear weapons in mind. The Iranians are building a heavy water reactor that is exactly like the other heavy water reactors that have been built for weapons in the world. It's about 40 megawatts, a lot bigger than you need for research, but it's too small to make power. So the question is, what are you going to do with this reactor? Well, the Pakistanis, the Indians, and the Israelis have all built heavy water reactors of this size, and they're all being used to make bombs. And so when you see a country making a 40 megawatt heavy water reactor, that's a pretty clear indication that they have bad ideas in the back of their heads.
I am not in a position to say you are right, you are wrong. What I do is check the facts, verify the Iranian program, and so far I haven't seen any concrete proof that what Iran is doing is directly linked to a weapon program.
The Iranians have adopted a strategy of playing for time, which was the same strategy the North Koreans adopted. And by the way, it's still working pretty well for the North Koreans.
So nuclear weapons became such a big issue, but what's happened in more recent times is terrorist attacks. And so the UN created a counterterrorism committee, and yet what again has occurred is man's attempts to assuage war have led to just more incompetence and more failure at what we want to do. The UN has yet to determine what a terrorist is. They can't define it. And so, of course, they can't do much about it. They can't define what is a terrorist nation or what isn't. And so they can do very little, if anything at all.
Soon after the attack, the global reach of the terrorists became clear. We turned to the only truly universal organization, the United Nations, and it delivered. The UN quickly passed Resolution 1373, the most sweeping anti-terror document it had ever enacted. Resolution 1373 compelled countries to stop the travel, safe haven, and financing of terrorists.
The impetus was clearly the attacks in New York and Washington on 9/11. And the executive director of the counterterrorism executive directorate of the counterterrorism committee of the Security Council. It was not only the impetus to the Security Council or to the United Nations, it was the impetus to the whole world. Because that was the day, that was the moment when the whole world came to realize that we were facing a new and very serious threat.
So what are the awesome tools that the Counterterrorism Committee uses to stop the terrorists?
We got a number of reports coming from the countries telling us what they were doing. Quite a number of countries in the United Nations do not know how to draft a report, if you want. So in many instances, the first thing we've been doing is to tell them how to respond, how to fill the report.
What do you do to enforce the resolution?
Well, in the case of those countries which are very obviously do not comply, because they do not want to comply, we send a mission made up of people coming from the director, from my people. We go there, we talk to them, and all those people stay in the country for a rather long time, around a week.
I used to call the Counterterrorism Committee the Pro-Tourism Committee. Among the trips that they have taken recently was Kenya, nice for safari, Thailand, before the tsunami, of course. I mean, but they would not go to Afghanistan, for instance, or Iran. It's just another layer of the bureaucracy, more than fighting terrorism, international terrorism, efficiently.
Who's on your list of terrorist organizations?
According to myself, I don't have a list. And according to the Counterterrorism Committee, they don't have a list either.
And who would you say are the most active state sponsors of terror?
Well, for obvious reasons, I shouldn't name names. This is not the practice of the United Nations. This is not the practice of the Counterterrorism Committee.
The UN has never said that a particular nation is or is not a sponsor of terrorism.
If they can't actually name them, then how do they discipline state sponsors of terror? Less than 1 month after September 11th and 11 days after enacting Resolution 1373, Syria was elected to sit on the Security Council.
Syria provides safe haven to terrorist organizations, headquarters, training facilities, infrastructure, intelligence.
Syria is arming Hezbollah in Lebanon. Syria has and Iran have been responsible for bringing tens of thousands of rockets into that area. Those rockets aren't for self-defense.
It sponsors, pays for, and arms Hezbollah, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, Hamas, and other terrorist organizations.
Despite its deep connections with terrorism, Syria was elevated to the presidency of the Security Council.
So there are a number of countries which certainly could improve the performance as far as terrorism is concerned.
Maybe the problem is more fundamental than I thought.
How does the UN define terrorism?
Well, technically, the United Nations so far has not been able to define terrorism.
No, the UN member states have not been able to agree upon a definition of terrorism.
Definition of terrorism is a very difficult thing.
And this is one of the pending matters in the United Nations.
I'm sure it's still pending. You know, again, I think one of the individuals interviewed there said it very well, that it was process, and no practical solutions or actions are taken. And again, it becomes paperwork, and that's about all. And what's even worse, the counterterrorism department doesn't keep track of its resources. And so where do you think some of those resources fall? They fall into terrorist hands.
UNRWA has a very poor idea of where its resources are used, or, for example, whether its vehicles are used in terrorist attacks. We have seen tapes of vehicles clearly marked on the roof as UNRWA vehicles with RPG weapons being loaded to carry out attacks.
So the UN is directing our tax dollars to decorate offices and fund ambulance ride-alongs. At least their schools are teaching kids some good old-fashioned cheers. And outside this UNRWA school in Bethlehem, during an after-school program, children painted a mural memorializing a female suicide bomber.
She was a Shaheed?
Yes.
Yeah. But isn't being a Shaheed a man's job?
Yes.
Great.
It reflects, at best, a complete incompetence in the management of the resources which were given to them by the international community, and a lack of control of those resources to keep them out of the hands of terrorists.
Is it true that UNRWA personnel and equipment are being used to commit terrorist attacks?
I don't think they are. No, I would have to look into that. No, I don't think they are close to... No.
That's the man in charge of the counterterrorism committee. Anyway, the UN also is responsible for one of the largest scams probably in history for what we know, but it was a food for oil scam that went on in Iraq. And so what happened was we put sanctions on them, but then we realized the people were not getting any food or any medicine, and so we allowed them to sell a certain limited amount of oil in order to get money for the people. But the money didn't go to the people. The money went to Saddam Hussein, and then he used it to bribe UN personnel. So he was so he would keep getting the money. It's an interesting story. Let's have a look at it.
At the UN, no one has gone to jail, no one has even been fired for the biggest scam in the history of humanitarian relief.
He was making some people rich. Did Saddam Hussein expect nothing in return?
Saddam did expect something in return. Protection. He bought off Security Council seats so that the UN would allow him to continue to pillage the Oil for Food program. And those same Security Council members would veto any military action against Iraq. But Saddam's bribery scheme didn't end there. Among his targets was a secretary general.
The Iraqis were incredible record takers. Boutros Boutros-Ghali's name appears on the documents where the Iraqis were attempting to bribe him to get the best deal on the Memorandum of Understanding.
At the root of the Oil for Food scheme was the Memorandum of Understanding. This agreement laid out the structure of the program. It was personally negotiated by Boutros Boutros-Ghali. This was the document that gave Saddam free rein.
You can see in the Oil for Food documentation that they were allocating things with Boutros Boutros-Ghali's name or companies or organizations that he was affiliated with. That's where the connection gets made.
And if you believe their records, the money was allocated and the money was delivered.
Well, the Iraqi people got ripped off with this deal. There's no question about it.
This resolution is based on one of the most important objectives of the United Nations, to alleviate the problem of poverty and the poorest of the poor were suffering in Iraq.
At the end of the day, it was not complicated what we had to do. We had to tell the truth. And in long, long reports, we managed to tell everything but this fundamental truth.
Yeah, it's amazing. Perhaps the most, probably the greatest failure of the UN took place in Rwanda. It's difficult for us, I think, to understand or believe the lack of concern for human life, but it's existed from ancient history down through the ages and still exists to this very day. In this case, the UN knew that the Tutsis were going to be attacked and that the Hutu were going to attempt genocide on these people. And the UN did nothing to stop it. They did nothing to intervene in this case. In fact, they did supply money to even help them. And again, what you see is horrible brutality, and you see man's ineptness and our incompetence and our self-serving in the corruption that takes place in such a place as the UN, where their job, their mission, is to bring peace to the world and eliminate the suffering of the poor nations and starving people and so on. And the reason that they did nothing in this case of genocide was that Boutros-Ghali was selling arms to the brutal enemy. 800,000 Tutsis were killed. 800,000 were killed as they turned their eyes away from it. And Boutros-Ghali turned his back on what was occurring so he could make money off of it. Go ahead and start the video.
There have been moments in time when evil, banal men conspire to exterminate a race of people from the world. Such a moment occurred at a palatial home in the suburbs of Berlin. It was there that men decided to wipe out the Jewish race from the face of the earth. We may never know if such a moment occurred in Rwanda. What we do know is that a genocide took place. Between April and July 1994, nearly 1 million men, women, and children were exterminated. The UN had a peacekeeping mission in place well before the genocide began. The mission was in Rwanda to monitor the security situation in the period leading up to new elections. It was led by Canadian General Roméo Dallaire and Belgian Lieutenant Luc Marchal.
It was strange because on the one hand, here's groups of UN soldiers fully decked out, and we used to joke, you can't spit without hitting a UN car. There was an incredible sense of security in that. And yet we also knew things were going to blow.
Rwanda was on the brink. The violence was getting worse. The militia was increasing. Political assassinations, grenades being distributed, more and more rumors about lists.
They had lists of Tutsis that they were going to kill, that the UN was aware of. It's right out of the Holocaust, right? Lists of names of Tutsis, really well organized, down to the cellular level.
The conspiracy to exterminate the Tutsi population of Rwanda was very well known. Genocide hung in the air.
If the rumors weren't enough, it wasn't long before the UN got direct confirmation.
An informer came forward from the heart of the Intrahamwe militia. Luc Marchal met this man at night with a candle on a table in between them. He tells them that lists are being made, there's quite obviously weapons caches, that the youth of the country is being trained to kill, he said, 1,000 people every 20 minutes.
General Dallaire writes an urgent cable to his superior in New York, Kofi Annan, who is then the head of peacekeeping. The cable details the informant's revelations. General Dallaire ends the cable in his native tongue. Where there's a will, there's a way. Let's go.
Hell yeah, we knew in Rwanda. Hell yeah, they knew. Mr. Anand's office knew. Clear line of faxes from General Dallaire saying, here's what's going to happen, and here's modest authority I request. Operational authority doesn't need Security Council approval. And one of them was just literally to protect and seize an arms cache. That's a pretty modest military operation. And militarily, it would do what it would do. But more than that, it would send a signal that we in the UN know, and that he was told no. He was told stand down. And he was told, it's literally, quote unquote, it's more important for you to protect the image of impartiality of the UN in the face of genocide than it is for you to take these rather modest operations.
Were you or the other members of the Security Council made aware of Dallaire's cable?
No, it was never brought to my attention, and I know from talking to many of the other 15 ambassadors that it came as a complete and horrifying surprise to them as well. The Security Council was never apprised of this at all.
I literally felt that I had been chopped at the knees. That I had this thing in the bag and that it had been taken away from me.
Kofi Annan and his team failed to act on this opportunity to stop the genocide before it started. Soon after, the spark that lit the inferno came in the form of a rocket launcher. In the early hours of April 6, 1994, the plane carrying the presidents of Rwanda and neighboring Burundi were shot down near the Kigali airport by unknown assassins. Within minutes, roadblocks were erected and the Hutu militias began searching for Tutsis.
That morning, units from these elite battalions were given orders to go to certain places and kill every single person they found with a Tutsi identity card. The Tutsi were under no doubt at all of what was going to happen, so fled to churches, clinics, and schools.
One such school was École Technique Officielle, simply known as ETO. The United Nations flew its flag over the school, beckoning refugees to enter and draping the protection of the UN onto all. Over a short period of time, the school had collected nearly 2,500 Tutsi refugees, many of them children and the elderly. As the refugees were massed in the school, the Hutu militia began to gather outside its gates. They cruised menacingly around the perimeter of the school, getting drunk and shouting invectives like Hutu power and kill the cockroaches. The UN military radioed their headquarters asking for instructions. Shockingly, they were told to evacuate and leave all their charge behind. As the trucks left one by one, the refugees quickly realized what was happening. They began to hang on to the departing trucks. The United Nations soldiers responded by firing in the air and throwing their protectees off of their trucks. People begged the soldiers to shoot them, knowing that the alternative was to die by the blade of a blood-soaked machete. The soldiers cleared the area. Within minutes, the Hutu militia entered the school with their machetes, hammers, knives, and spears, and began their massacre. General Dallaire continued to send cables back to his superiors in New York. He detailed to them what was happening on the ground and asked for their go-ahead to stop the slaughter from escalating into a genocide. But a crucial piece of the UN machinery was missing.
Oh, Boutros Ghali was away from New York at the time that the crisis commenced.
Boutros Ghali was on a three-week tour of Europe, which he refused to cancel.
B-A-C-A-T-I-O-N.
His senior officials were absolutely stunned when he didn't return immediately to New York in this sudden crisis. Two African presidents assassinated in the skies over Kigali. A civil war begins, and then there is a program of mass extermination, and he fails to cancel his tour of Europe.
In his defense, Boutros Ghali was busy receiving honorary degrees across Europe.
Boutros Ghali, for reasons which I don't understand, had barred people like Kofi Annan, who was in charge of peacekeeping, from ever coming to the Security Council to brief it.
Only he controls the flow of information to the council. From European cities, he decides what information is given to the council. How can he do that?
Boutros Ghali resented the Security Council being involved in the details, accusing us of micromanaging what the UN was doing in the field. Certainly his attitude towards the appropriate role of the member states and the appropriate role of the Secretary General was dysfunctional.
Was it dysfunctional or was it something else? As Boutros Ghali continued to collect honorary degrees while the genocide raged on, was he thinking, maybe I should return to New York?
He was more knowledgeable about Rwanda than any other senior member of his staff.
Or maybe he was thinking, didn't a report about this come across my desk more than 6 months ago? The conclusions were probably too vague. Or was he thinking, they're going to find out that I sold weapons to Rwanda?
I interviewed Boutros Ghali, and I talked to him about how he had facilitated this arms deal. There are letters from the government of Rwanda to the government of Egypt praising Boutros Ghali's role, saying that his role was a determining factor, and they speak of his personal intervention. And he readily admitted it. He said that he'd been a catalyst. And then he said of what happened later in Rwanda, well, I don't think a few thousand guns would have made any difference.
Where was the money coming from to fund all the weaponry?
The loans came from the World Bank and the IMF. Your taxes and mine.
The IMF and the World Bank are both agencies of the United Nations.
Rwanda was among the poorest countries in the world, and yet it had a government that became one of the biggest spending African countries on military, if not the biggest. They siphoned the money from these loans. Instead of using them to run the government, they used them to buy weaponry.
These weapons were not being bought in secret. In fact, the World Bank sent five different missions to check out where the money was being spent and repeatedly warned Rwanda to cease the weapons purchases. Rwanda refused. The UN financial bureaucracy responded by granting another $120 million in loans.
So there you see, this is man's best attempt to assuage war, to assuage the suffering around this world. And it's a complete failure because it ends up, as it always has throughout history, of men using their power to protect themselves, to provide for themselves without thought of others or the pain or suffering they might be experiencing. And so I think it will go on, and we're going to see a final genocide take place in which, if Christ didn't intervene, then no flesh will be left alive. But my point today is that you and I are called for this very purpose. That is, we're to be peacekeepers. We're going to be peacekeepers in the world to come. And we have this mission, and we must not forget our mission. We must not get distracted with self-interest. We must not get distracted by those things that are corrupt. We have a mission. And the world is waiting. It's not going to hang its head in shame until Christ returns, and we return with him. Let's go to Mark 9 just for a minute here. Mark 9. An end to corruption is coming. An end to politicking is coming. And we have an opportunity to be part of God's Reformation. Mark 9. And this to me is a privilege of a lifetime to be called now for this purpose. and that we must not let down. And I see over the years, as we have moved into separation from our parent organization and so on, that we have many cases, in many cases we have let down. And Mark 9 in verse 50 says this: "Salt is good, but if the salt has lost its saltiness, wherewith will you season it? Have salt in yourselves and have peace with one another." And that's where it starts. We have to have peace with one another. And I say this: how in the world can we have what I see today as church wars? You know, how can God's people be fighting and be antagonistic towards others? Because I know groups, churches, that will actually treat unconverted people better than they would treat people in another group. And I see people elevating themselves, using religion to do that. Do you understand what I'm trying to get at? That we are fighting one another instead of serving one another. And that's happening in God's church. And then there's family wars. You know, I'll never forget when I was first hired on, I took over 5, 6, 7 churches in California, and I'm approachable, I'm easy to get along with, and I'm not judgmental, you know. And so people were coming to me there, and they were telling me what was really going on, because they couldn't tell the ministers before, because the ministers wanted just a nice, smooth sailing. They didn't want to hear it, and you were a bad person if you had problems. And so often people kept quiet about their problems. But I was approachable, and I found there were all kinds of problems, and that there were marriages where someone was getting pushed. There were marriages where someone was being yelled at. There were marriages where someone was cursing at somebody. There were these things taking place. But you understand, that's the spirit of war? That's the spirit of murder? Not the spirit of peace? The way of peace they know not. But we know. It's right here in this book. And it is in the Holy Spirit that's in us. The salt that saves and preserves. And we've got this opportunity of more than a lifetime to be privileged to be peacekeepers in the world to come. And we've got to take our mission seriously. And we've got to work to have peace with one another first before we're ever going to be allowed to be peacemakers in the world to come. And so let's be about our Father's business. And let's work to have peace among one another and in our families.